Welcome to the Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com, and this week I'm talking to Recluse of Bicep. Thing as you mentioned Manson, do you want to start there?
Sure, if you want to like start off in the specific discussions here about it. Like I said, I don't know what exactly you wanted to cover or not.
Well, I generally don't. Sometimes I've got no idea, but with you, because you know you do a lot of information gathering, so I do have a general idea with you. But now we have we have a fork in the road, so to speak. We've got on the left, we've got Peter Lavender and Kenneth Grant and UFO weirdness. And then on the right, we've got Charles Manson, Ren Polanski and Hollywood weirdness. So hopefully, I mean, they do kind of overlap. I mean, everything overlaps eventually, doesn't it? But it's almost like an East Coast, West Coast thing, maybe. I don't know. I mean, Kenneth Grant, I don't know where he was located, but Lavender's thing was on the East Coast for sure. But I mean, we could start either, whichever you feel would be a better place to start.
Well, we could maybe go with Lavender to start with, because I'm a little more, I've been dealing with that subject a little more lately. And obviously, I kind of wanted to get into Boney Fuller at some point and maybe some other things with Crowley, because I think I've come up with some pretty interesting research on that hasn't really seemed to have gotten a lot of play from Crowley experts and so forth.
Good luck, yeah, getting them to acknowledge it. If it's anything like I imagine it's going to be, yeah. Okay, so let's do that. So what have you got?
In relation to what exactly, Crowley?
Well, let's start with Lavender.
Okay.
Yeah, let's start with Lavender. I could sum up my position of Lavender. I could try. I'm very poor at summing up, or at least I dislike having to do it. But in the last 3 years or so, I've become more and more suspicious of Peter Lavender, although we've had two very long and very enjoyable conversations, one for the Limitless and the other for Stormy Weather. And he's always been, you know, friendly enough and open enough. I think the first thing that really made me suspicious was his long association with Whitley Strieber, and they consider themselves friends and they go way back. And his glowing review of Supernatural, which I consider to be quite a dubious work, I really got into it with Peter Lavender over Crowley. The first time I got in an altercation with Lavender was over when I was writing Prisoner Infinity, and I was sharing some of my thoughts about the psychological underpinnings of the alien abduction experience and the relationship to trauma and dissociation, and he took umbrage with it, and he acted as though I was daring to suggest that there was no physical reality to it at all, and that it was insensitive, to as if, you know, he was saying it was the equivalent of treating kidnapped victims as if it was all in their mind, kind of thing. So we got off. We didn't really, you know, connect on that. And then, but it was okay. It didn't, you know, drive a wedge between us. But when I brought up my questions about Crowley being involved in child sexual abuse, he kind of did everything he could to shut me down, I would say. I mean, he was hitting me with arguments, but mainly his argument was that he was more informed than I was, and he was an insider, and he knew about occult secret societies and rituals and Golden Dawn, this, that and the other, and there was absolutely no evidence for child sex abuse, and if there was, you could be sure that he would have found it and he'd have written about it. So it became just an impossible situation, really. Anyway, I posted that online with his permission, and that did become a chapter in Vice of Kings. So it was helpful to some extent, but it definitely made me increasingly suspicious of Lavender. And then the more I looked into him, the more strange things I found. So specifically his involvement as Simon with the Necronomicon, his being a former, no, a member of the Association of,
Association of Former Intelligence Officers.
right, that thing, his praising Michael Aquino's book at Amazon, looking at the Simon material, finding out that it definitely does advocate child sexual magic rituals with children. It's right there in one of the books that Lavender wrote or co-wrote as Simon. So yeah, I just found it absolutely overwhelming, the evidence that he wasn't being straight up and honest with me. And so we haven't, he's attacked, well, I don't want to say attacked, I don't want to, become a snowflake here, but he was definitely very dismissive and derogatory about me on the Secret Sun blog. So I've clearly pissed him off, and that's pretty much where we're at in terms of, I haven't tried to contact him or ask him anything at this point. I'm satisfied that, well, that he's not really what he claims to be. So how about yourself? Have you tried to talk to Lavender about this, or have you just been doing your research separately
Well,
from
separately, I mean, I've actually kind of been wanting to contact Lavinda for years now, just to sort of bounce some different ideals off of him. But certainly, like you, I've become rather disillusioned lately, especially in relation to the To the Stars Academy and so forth. And
Right.
recently, I had really been taking a look at him closer after actually Christopher Knowles, of course, of the Secret Sun, had asked me to look at Kenneth Grant, who is generally considered to be one of Crowley's greater acolytes out there, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that had definitely led to some interesting thoughts about the Association of Former Intelligence Officers. And should probably pause for a second and go over that a little bit, because certainly that's not really an organization that a lot of people are familiar with, even those that are kind of deeply involved in conspiracy research and so forth.
Yeah.
So this mysterious network was set up in the early 70s, and one of the first people, well, the co-founders of it, was a man named David Atlee Phillips, who was a longtime CIA officer in the Southern Hemisphere. Now, Atlee Phillips is very well known to Kennedy assassination researchers due to the fact that he is the man who is generally believed to have been the pseudonym that was ascribed as Maurice Bishop. Bishop was really active with a lot of the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans and so forth, and a lot of Kennedy researchers believe that he was a crucial figure within the assassination and the plotting and so forth. So David Atlee Phillips was definitely, a heavy within these kind of dark arts and so forth. He was the guy who set up the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, and the first time it was really used in a large scale was during the coup d'etat in Chile, which unfolded actually on September 11th, 1973, that brought Pinochet to power. And this is, of course, really interesting in light of Lavinda's career, because he was very, interested in this whole region, specifically due to Colonia Dignidad.
Right.
Colonia Dignidad had predated the coup by, I believe, over a decade, if not longer. But when Pinochet came to power, it was essentially, brought into the intelligence services and security apparatus. It was essentially used as a torture site slash black site for a lot of the more unsavory things that were going on in Chile at the time, and also to kind of coordinate what became known as Operation Condor. This is something I'm going to get into a lot more in my forthcoming work that has an enormous essay on Colonia Dignidad. It's probably the largest one in English written yet. But anyway, that's one of the things that I find really baffling about Lavinda showing up in the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, because he has to have known the role that it played in Chile. And I say that because one of the books that he cited in Unholy Alliance is one that I used for my own research, and it's actually one of the only accounts, I believe by an author named Donald Freed. I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but it's one of the only accounts of the early history of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, and it was also one of the first accounts of Colonia Dignidad, for that matter. So Lavendia had to know about these connections, and yet he turns up in this organization later on, which I find to be quite curious, given the extreme opposition that he's tried to display publicly to the colony.
Right.
So that's a bit of a contradiction. So He ends up in the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, and specifically, he's involved with the Las Vegas chapter, which seems to be just an absolute mecca for high weirdness. Some of the other guys who are involved in the Las Vegas chapter include Richard Doty, who is a veteran of the Air Force Office of Special Investigation. He has been a major figure in UFO circles since the early 1980s. He's been linked to the Benowitz affair, where essentially they planted the kind of notion of the Dulce underground bases in New Mexico and the far north and so forth, and essentially drove this eccentric businessman Paul Benowitz into a kind of nervous breakdown. Doty has been known to spread disinformation in the UFO circles for years. He's been a major manipulator behind it, and he's probably one of the least unsavory of some of the other people involved in it. Another big one is Colonel John Alexander, the major proponent of non-lethal weapons, which is a bit of an oxymoron, to put it mildly. Alexander was involved in a lot of the military remote viewing things that were going on in the 1980s, and he was put into contact with General Stubblefield, who was at the time the head of Army Intelligence, and who also had a key interest in a lot of this type of stuff. And bizarrely, the guy who set up Alexander was Stubblefield, was a guy named General Richard Stilwell. Stilwell had been involved with the CIA for a lot of years, and I mean, he turns up in a lot of unsavory things, specifically the Phoenix program and a lot of the drug trafficking that was also related to that. Now, Stilwell, going into the late 70s, early 80s, it also became a major proponent of what became the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, which is, I mean, it's really kind of surpassed the CIA as the lead for covert operations that America is currently running now. It's what houses the Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, and a lot of the other elite special operations forces. So, I mean, Stilwell was definitely a major, major figure in a lot of these kind of dark corners of the American deep state. And I've often found it very interesting that he had this relationship with Alexander, and he was the one who had kind of encouraged Alexander to start investigating some of these more fringe topics, especially like with the Jedi Project and Alexander's obsession with neurolinguistic programming and so forth. So it's, very curious. And then the other guy who shows up in the Association of Former Intelligence Officers is, I'm sure, someone you're quite familiar with, and that is Colonel Michael Aquino.
Right.
Aquino is there with Lavenda, with Alexander, and with Doty. And the thing about Aquino and Lavenda that's very interesting is both of these guys are big proponents of specifically Kenneth Grant's strand of Crowleyanism, the whole kind of, was it the Typhonian tradition, sets, mm-hmm. the Dark Lord, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and that to me is very unsettling. I mean, Grant, of course, was one of the first figures to really link Lovecraft's kind of demonic space gods, if you will, to the modern UFO phenomenon and so forth. So you've got Lavenda, who's now, a major figure within To the Stars Academy, and it does certainly make me wonder, what exactly is going on with some of these connections? Is there some kind of bizarre Grant cult that is operating at the center of To the Stars Academy, and what exactly are the implications behind something like that? I mean, certainly it's a rather unsettling prospect. I mean, this is something that I've talked with Knowles about, but Grant really seems to have been the guy who was driving a lot of these darker obsessions that were really underpinning a lot of the Crowley type types in the post-war years. Certainly, I think Knowles is a big believer that he was one of the figures who had really promoted the sexual abuse of minors. He had recently done quite an excellent blog on the British TV series Cracker that came out in the 90s. There's a second season, there's a series of episodes that essentially deal with a woman that was murdered ritualistically and seems to have been involved with a cult whose leader was named Kenneth Tarrant or something like that. Very similar to Grant. There seems to be a possibility that there were some tales being told out of school with this, certainly. So, the whole thing with this Las Vegas chapter of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, it's very strange and very unsettling, especially when you consider how big the disclosure movement has become again in the last year or so, and the fact that To the Stars Academy is really driving it, and you have these kind of acolytes of Grant that are lingering in the background.
Mm-hmm. So just staying on the Association of Former Intelligence Officers for a moment, officially they are, what are they officially, would you say, as compared to what you think that they are?
Well, officially, they're just basically, you know, a collection of former intelligence officers from the CIA and a lot of guys actually from the various branches of military intelligence in the United States, the DIA, the Office of Naval Intelligence, G2, and the Army, and so forth. But yes, I mean, essentially, they're kind of, you know, I think the perception would be they get together, they kind of, swap old war stories about the good old days and that type of thing. So yes, I would imagine many of the members would insist that they're a very benevolent group. There's no kind of nefarious activities behind them, but
like a social network almost.
Yes, essentially, you know, kind of a way to keep track with your old comrades at arms and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But certainly the, you know, just the people involved with this, I mean, a lot of former CIA directors, a lot of very high placed military men and so forth, tends to lead to some implications that they might be a kind of shadow body behind the U.S. intelligence community.
Well, this is the saying, there's no such thing as a retired intelligence officer. I mean, I heard that in my 20s. So, this is indicating that, and if that, to the extent that that's true, if they're more or less just like an intelligence agency, why create a front of this kind? What does it allow them to do that they wouldn't be able to do if they just, you know, carried on working behind the scenes for the intelligence agencies that they never really retired from?
Well, I think it's essentially to get some distance between the official intelligence bodies, and also, I mean, in a way to kind of ensure plausible deniability for them and so forth. I mean,
like Lavender does.
I mean, you can again kind of see this with the first real instance of the association being rolled out in Chile. I mean, Pinochet's coup was brutal. I mean, it didn't have an especially high body count, but I mean, it did. It went to great lengths to employ rather cutting-edge psychological warfare methods at the time. And this was also unfolding at a time when there was increasing reluctance for the United States to become involved overseas in these types of things. Of course, this is when the Vietnam War had really started to become profoundly unpopular in the country and so forth around 1973. So the CIA at the time, it just wasn't politically expedient to be directly involved in something like this. But you get a bunch of these, you know, quote unquote, former intelligence officers kind of working behind the scene. Well, now, you know, you've got a bit of a screen, so to speak, between the official bodies and what these guys in supposedly a private capacity are doing.
Right. Even though they're not supposed to be doing anything. Hanging out, I suppose, and drinking. So, and what about Lavender then specifically? Because he has gone on record as acknowledging, or even maybe he himself put it out there, the fact that he belongs to that organization. I don't remember, but he's, either way, he's managed to spin it in such a way as to say, oh no, I just got in on the sort of clause of, because I've researched, and I can't remember the specifics. Do you remember the specifics of how he...
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't think he's ever really offered a really compelling explanation as to how he ended up in this organization. Certainly, I don't buy the fact that he would have been invited in because he was just, you know, a great researcher or something like that. I mean, again, this is an organization that tends to attract very, very senior figures in the intelligence community, and the fact that they would tap a guy who had, you know, basically written rather obscure books on Nazi occultism or something to be in it is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and not really, apparently not favorite books about intelligence operations.
Yes, certainly. But again, you have to kind of go back to Lavenda's early years with the American Orthodox Catholic Church. This was a group that had ties to a rather nefarious organization that I've done a lot of research on. I've written them a couple of times on my blog, and it was known as the Sovereign Order of St. John of Jerusalem. It was a pseudo Knights of Malta outfit. It claimed descent from the Knights of Malta through the Russian lineage. This was after they were effectively booted off of the island of Malta around the end of the 18th century. Mm. For a while, they were homeless. Some of the knights were given patronage by the Russians. They migrated there. though this network essentially went kaput in the early 19th century. But the SOSJ, the modern version, essentially claimed that they had gone underground and gradually they had immigrated to the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century, and then finally they were ready to come out in the open by the 1950s or something to that effect, which I tend to think is ludicrous. The founder, Grand Master, head, whatever you want to call him, Charles Michel, was a Nazi collaborator who had been imprisoned for that. He had been linked to drug trafficking, a host of other nefarious activities, so to speak. So you have this guy who had been a Nazi collaborator, a petty criminal, with this grandiose claim of this secret society, and yet he managed to attract a lot of very senior and high-ranking military officers. Probably the chief among them was General Charles Willoughby. Willoughby had been MacArthur's intelligence chief throughout the Second World War and going into Korea, and that's quite significant. I mean, the general perception is that when the Second World War broke out, the OSS took over all intelligence functions for the United States the world over, and this is not accurate. MacArthur despised the OSS. He had a very ambiguous relationship with Donovan, and he and Willoughby had effectively kept the OSS out of the Far East. So it was Willoughby's G2 that was the chief intelligence network in this entire region of the world, and this really continued, excuse me, continued all the way up to Korea. And in this capacity, Willoughby got involved in a lot of nefarious things. He was essentially the guy that, brought a lot of the Yakuza and what have you into the ruling coalition in Japan. He was the guy that had saved Unit 731, which had been involved in a lot of the Japanese chemical and biological warfare programs and so forth. Essentially, he was doing the same thing in Japan that the OSS and later the CIA were doing with Paperclip in Europe and so forth. So Willoughby was a big guy, very, very powerful. And when he was finally drummed out of the service with MacArthur during Korea, a lot of the guys that had been connected with him essentially formed their own kind of old boys network. And these two kind of networks, the OSS old boys and the MacArthur old boys, were really kind of the driving factors behind the US deep state for a lot of years throughout the 50s, 60s, probably all the way up to the 70s, maybe even a little into the 1980s and so forth. So Willoughby's in there. He's in there with a lot of these other, OSS old boys. One was Admiral, Char excuse me, MacArthur old boys. Another one was Admiral Charles Cook. He was the guy that had set up the expedition to normalize relations with Taiwan, which was essentially an apartheid country that had been set up by a drug lord, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. That was probably a major factor in facilitating the transfer of massive amounts of heroin into the United States as well, but that's another topic. You had Colonel Philip J. Corso, who had been involved in setting up stay-behind operations in Germany, what would kind of now be referred to as Gladio, though that's not actually an accurate title, but whatever. Corso is most well known now for the publication of The Day After Roswell, which was the big book that really went into the, allegations about the Roswell crash and the recovery of the technology from UFOs and so forth. Another very bizarre figure in the SOSJ was a guy named Cleve Baxter, who was their quote-unquote interrogation specialist. Baxter's usually depicted as a buffoonish figure because his research was what had underpinned a book called The Secret Life of Plants. Essentially, he alleged that you could hook up a polygraph machine to a plant and communicate with it effectively. The thing with Baxter, though, is he was a member of the Army Counterintelligence Corps in the late 40s or mid 40s, and then later went into probably the Office of Security in the CIA. I would bet money that he had participated in Artichoke because he was essentially an interrogation specialist. So, this was a guy who was probably involved in some of this, mind control, behavior modification stuff, whatever you want to call it. And these are just a couple of the highlights of some of the people that were involved in the SOSJ. So, as far as the connections to Lavenda go, this is kind of an interesting one. One of the SOSJ members who was involved in the American Orthodox Catholic Church was a guy named Carl Maria Stanley, who I believe later had himself declared a saint. Anyway, Stanley's big claim to fame is that he was actually the man who had ordained David Ferry a priest. Ferry, for those of you out there who are not familiar with him, was played by Joe Pesci in Oliver Stone's classic JFK film. He's a guy who's long been suspected as being a pivotal figure in the assassination in New Orleans, but more to the point, he was also an arch abuser of children. He literally molested dozens of children in the New Orleans area from the late 1950s all the way up through the early 60s. In fact, there's been a lot of speculation for years that Oswald himself had been sexually abused by Ferry. So this is the guy that was involved in the OSCC with Lavenda and some of these other figures. Also a guy who was linked to the SOSJ, which I should kind of emphasize, was also one of the major proponents of what is known as Christian identity theology, a rather toxic notion that is kind of a warped Gnosticism that effectively holds whites as being the divine race or something to that effect, and virtually everyone else is kind of a subhuman demonic being. The Christian Identity Network has been linked to legions of acts of terrorism over the years, including the Oklahoma City bombing, the National States Rights Party, which has produced a lot of terrorists, including Fraser Glenn Miller and J.B. Stoner, who bombed several African American churches in the 50s and 60s. It produced the serial killer. This is the Christian Identity Theology. It produced the serial killer Israeli Keyes. It's left a rather considerable body count across the country over several decades now, and the SOSJ was a major proponent of this. It also essentially helped set up the modern militia movement and the, was it, sovereign citizen movement, free man on the land, whatever you want to call it. So this was an organization that has rather extensive ties to terrorism, and also had this bizarre connection to David Ferry, arch pedophile, and so forth. And Lavenda has almost surely brushed elbows with people involved with the SOSJ. And one of the Simon books, he does make references to the obsession with chivalric orders within the American Orthodox Catholic Church. But he's always been rather cautious about what he says on that topic.
It's been a long way, son.
Right, well, speaking of that, what the vendor says and what kind of caution he exercises, what is his game, do you think? Because you're really digging, but the stuff that I came up about the vendor, anybody could come across. I mean, he talks about it, some of his own writing and so on. So he's clearly not... I mean, a lot of the clues that led me to suspect that Lavenda was not just a former intelligence officer, but a current, you know, working intelligence officer disguised as a conspiracy theory researcher, it would have been easy to have concealed all that stuff. So my sense is that as part of the game that he's playing is this, is he or isn't he? Like, he's got plausible deniability. It was not plausible to me, but a lot of his followers poo-poo the suggestion, or they don't seem to care. So, I mean, have you thought about that, or have you factored that into the picture that you're trying to create? Like, there seems to be an element of, I don't know what you'd call that, but I suppose it's kind of teasing with this, the hints and the indications and the things that could have been concealed, but that he chose not to conceal, that really are bound to raise suspicion sooner or later.
Well, it seems like a lot of, you know, the direct references him to being, you know, potentially an intelligence officer, either a current or former one, really started to emerge in the last couple of years. And this is roughly around the same time when there seems to have been a concerted effort to really, you know, rechristen the CIA as a heroic organization that's stood right against the horrors of the Trump administration and attempted to prevent it. And I mean, it kind of seems, you know, it plays into what's going on with the Las Vegas chapter of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers. These are, you know, honorable men who are willing to step forward and finally reveal the truth to the American public about UFOs and this type of thing.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, as to your question, I think you were sort of getting at earlier, like, what was the ultimate purpose? I mean, I think it really is very much a religious one. I mean, certainly when you look at a guy like Aquino and so forth in the same association with Lavenda, I mean, both of these guys, from what I can tell, are, you know, very serious occultists. Yeah. I would imagine John Alexander also has some very, you know, serious beliefs on this topic as well, certainly given some of the other arcane pursuits that he's had over the years. And, you know, as I was kind of hinting at earlier, that's what really disturbs me about this disclosure movement that's going on right now and being driven by Two of the Stars Academy. When you have these, you know, Grant followers kind of lurking in the background, do they see this as a potential platform to kind of unveil this, you know, kind of new religion to the public at large? Certainly, I think this is something that, you know, has to be factored in. And of course, you've had some UFO researchers like Jacques Vallée that have been warning for years about the psychological component behind the phenomenon and the fact that there have been intelligence services potentially trying to manipulate it to spiritual ends. And
yeah, he's not warning about that anymore though, Jacques Vallée, is he?
I haven't really followed a lot of his recent research, so I can't really weigh in on that. But
well, he's endorsing the American Cosmic. He's a character in it, a heroic character, needless to say, and he's also endorsing it on the back. So it seems that he's, although Pasulka's American Cosmic, it doesn't even mention the To the Stars DeLonge thing, it's definitely compatible with it, although it's more of a positive angle, which is one thing I wanted to ask you. Like, isn't there a contradiction in, if they're trying to create a new religion around the old gods, is that contradicted by the fact that the To the Stars thing, at least superficially, is framing these beings as malevolent, if it is? I mean, it seemed to me that it was, at least initially.
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, to some extent, yes, but I mean, certainly when you look at some of the cosmology that Kenneth Grant came up with, you know, especially with the influence of the Lovecraftian old ones, I don't know that there was ever really a concept of these, you know, entities being benevolent, which, yeah, I mean, that definitely raises some very disturbing prospects. I mean, my kind of fear is that we're almost seeing a scenario playing out like what was depicted in that that old John Carpenter movie from the mid-90s. It was called In the Mouth of Madness. Are you familiar with that?
The Lovecraft one, yeah.
Essentially, for those of you out there who aren't familiar with it, it revolves around an author named Sutter Kane, who was kind of meant to be a stand-in for Stephen King, and he's written a lot of these horror novels that revolve around these Lovecraftian entities. And after a while, it kind of seems like what he's writing about is starting to become a reality. The main character, a private detective, goes to this small town in New England, which appears to have essentially, come straight out of one of his novels. And the broader objective of what is going on is essentially a transformation of the human race into these essentially Lovecraftian old ones that the writer is trying to usher into the world.
Right.
So, especially when you kind of play into some of the things that have been going on with the connections between genetics and AI and some of the, insane perceptions about this. Of course, there was what's his name, Gordy Rose, I believe, who had compared the quantum computing and the AIs that were, being built for this to Lovecraftian old ones. So, to my mind, I mean, I don't know if it is necessarily contradictory. These entities may be malevolent, as most certainly probably are malevolent based on what To the Stars Academy is promoting them as being. And conversely, I don't know if the kind of high priests of this are necessarily very concerned about that. Some ex
Sure, but in terms of actually making it a an appealing or an attractive prospect to worship them as in the basis for a new religion, the Pasulka book is very, it's very easy to see how that dovetails with scientism and the techno-utopia, the way we've transferred our religious longing and desperation onto technology. The Pasulka book very much then transposes the UFO onto technology and thereby onto the divine, onto the sacred. So it's quite a tidy model that she presents, and it's quite, I wouldn't say convincing because it's very very obviously dodgy, but I mean it's well written and all the rest of it. The long thing seems to be different in a number of ways to that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying. I mean, I also think there might be a bit of trying to present these contrasting views and so forth as well. But I mean, I kind of think it might be going in though to kind of a broader transformation of our society. I mean, certainly, it seems like gradually the culture is becoming more violent. We're becoming more and more desensitized to this type of thing. And I think it's kind of getting to the point where some people are hoping when you do sort of roll out the, malevolent old ones, public at large may not may well be okay with that, may even see it as a desirable step, essentially weeding out the remnants of the human race, which has become kind of obsolete, and potentially replacing it with something that in theory will be better and superior.
Well, I mean, the other thing that's going on here, and this is something that I try to map in Prisoner Infinity, which with the second part focuses a lot on transhumanism, but the correlations between transhumanism and both Whitley Strieber's Visitors and Carlos Castaneda's Sorcery, which doesn't directly overlap with Kenneth Grant, but it's in the same general ballpark. But anyway, one of the common threads here is the disembodiment, the movement away from the physical and away from the organic into some hyperdimensional realm. Now, whether it's represented or accessed by technology, or whether through the manipulation of perception, via occult rituals or sorcery, there seems to be a common thread there. And so, if that was happening one way or another, it would have to be by technology for most people, as in they just download their consciousness into machines, which they're already doing by staring at their cell phones all the day. They wouldn't really care if the old ones were being unleashed on the earth because they would be already, in some other dimension of never-ending distraction, entertainment of the cinematic universe, I guess.
Certainly. I mean, almost kind of like what you could kind of see in the Spielberg movie Ready Player One, where essentially society is really, falling apart. And I mean, people almost don't even care because they're, strapped into these VR machines, living out their various fantasies. And certainly that is something that really disturbs me as we get into more and more of this kind of stuff. I mean, I definitely think it could be a crutch essentially to get people to ignore the deterioration of the physical world and what's going on, because, they have their gadgets, their devices, which gives them an escape from all of that. But I mean, another question too, I would kind of ask is, I mean, was any of this ideology being rolled out as well, potentially by the, you know, I mean, Grant acolytes and so forth? Is it even really intended for the public at large?
Right.
I mean, certainly when you look at some of the, you know, perceptions that have been kind of coming out with Jeffrey Epstein and his, you know, brushes with the scientific community, it really doesn't seem like they're really that concerned with the masses of humanity. This is potentially even an ideology simply for a godlike elite, effectively.
Yeah, right. Well, there's one thing in Grant that that I was curious about early on, because I got quite into Grant, as you know, even to the point of corresponding with him, and it was that he said the next phase of consciousness on the planet would be beetle consciousness, and that basically human beings were going to be supplanted in the new aeon by beetle entities.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that you know, is something that a lot of other individuals have started to latch on to. I mean, one of the guys I've been kind of interested in of late is a British philosopher called Nick Land, who is kind of one of the architects of what's known as neo-reaction or the Dark Enlightenment or something to that effect. He had started out in Warwick University in the 90s with the Cybernetic Cultural Research Unit, I believe, the CCRU. They came up with the notion of accelerationism, which essentially advocated greater doses of technology and capitalism. And Land had some very strange notions about all of this. Essentially, he believed, at least at this point, that capitalism had been created by an AI from the future that had gone back in time to essentially create the tools that would be necessary for its own creation. Mm-hmm. And in Land's, you know, vision, essentially, when we got to the stage where the AI would be ready, you know, humanity would be done away with effectively and replaced by something that would be better and superior. And certainly, I mean, as you're kind of indicating with Grant, this seems to be a reoccurring theme that's emerging from some of these elite circles, the notion that the human race itself has to be replaced.
Mm-hmm. And the beetle is an exoskeleton, so it's quite similar archetypal, if you like, or visually to a machine presence. So.
Certainly, and I mean, you know, you could kind of throw in Adrina Puharic into this as well. Of course, he famously channeled the Nine, quote-unquote, at some point around 1952, 1953. And I believe by the time he released Yuri in 1974, which was the first time that this, you know, insanity had really been acknowledged to the public at large, I believe by this point in time, the perception of the Nine is that they were consciousness that had transcended physical form and was now, you know, housed in a spaceship called Spectra or something to that effect. So, I mean, this definitely seems to have been a reoccurring theme among this elite ideology, the desire to transcend beyond the human form, possibly into, you know, a computer, into some kind of AI or something like that. Though in more recent years, it kind of seems like genetics has become more of an obsession, basically tampering with the human gene pool to the human genetic code to create something that is no longer a human homo sapien, something that is, you know, advanced beyond that with different, you know, genetic codes worked in from other species. And that was one of the things that I found really disturbing about Epstein's activities over the last decade or so. He had essentially, you know, retired from being a hedge fund manager, I believe, around the middle of the last decade, and had essentially only invested in genetic scientific research for the last decade or so of his life. So, you know, this was definitely something that was very much on his mind and probably a lot of his backers as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, he is an interesting flashpoint, Jeffrey Epstein, isn't he? One of many, I suppose, but because I just heard recently about these associations with you know, billionaire science and scientism, and there does seem to be a correlation in terms of, I mean, Jeffrey Epstein is now most famous for illicit sex trafficking, and including, you know, forced sex and even enslavement of children, or at least very young adults, but I'm sure that children were in there too. And I guess what you're if not hinting at what you're circling around here, is that there is a correlation here between the aspirations and ambitions of the elite and of this top-end science that seems to be driving a wedge into some unknown future, and what probably most people would assume was just the perks and the peccadilloes of the elite, as in, having sex with children, but as somehow central to the ideology that they're possessed by.
Well, certainly, and I mean, as horrific as a lot of the, revelations that have come out about Epstein and the sex trafficking and so forth, I mean, I honestly find the ties to the scientific community to be even more disturbing, because I mean, it certainly raises the possibility that, beyond blackmail purposes and so forth, and also possibly indulging in some bizarre occultic beliefs. The money generated from the sex trafficking may well have been used to fund what was essentially his quest for eugenics and genetic modification and so forth. So there's kind of also the specter that behind all of this was a way to raise money to essentially create some kind of scientific method to do away with humanity as a whole.
Yeah, well, that's a good nuts and bolts aspect to it as well. It certainly is overwhelming, isn't it? We're talking about these
To put it mildly, yeah.
these different spheres. That seem to cooperate, and they seem so complementary. So with organized crime and sex trafficking, we've got something that seems just so base that it just is appealing to and exploiting the most base human instincts. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got, and I've been looking at this, exploring it a bit with somebody like George Hodel, who's supposedly the Black Dahlia killer. But really, if you take any high-level elitist cultural figure who seems to be involved in child sexual abuse, and particularly if there's an occult aspect to it, as there was with Hodel, as with Crowley and Lavender, and any number of these characters, we could even kind of bring in Manson here, that there seems to be a rationale which is, say, is at the other end of the spectrum, which is, I'm going to have a difficult time putting words on it, but it's a delusionally transcendental aspiration to the highest possible attainment. Like it's an evolutionary drive, and
It's, I mean, like a lot of things, it's rationalized for the higher purpose, I guess you would say.
and I mean, I guess there's a danger that we get into areas where one can only speculate, but on the other hand, it seems to me anyway, it's very useful and helpful to try and psychoanalyze these drives, and because I think that they are shared, and to a large extent, I mean, you say that this ideology is maybe for the elite and they're not interested in the masses, but they definitely can't ignore the masses. And one of the ways I think that they, and I'm a bit wary about using a us and them thing, but have developed in order to neutralize the possible threat of the masses is to indoctrinate us with their ideology, but in just such a way that it will disempower us utterly rather than inspire us to try and, take them down and replace them. Although there is, I think Manson is an interesting case in this regard, because I think he was an outsider who was trying to infiltrate the upper echelons of the entertainment elite in Los Angeles, and I think he was emulating the same ideology, and probably because he was indoctrinated with it. And of course, he failed. I mean, he succeeded insofar as he could become super famous, but only as the shadow, as the boogeyman. Most of us, if we aspire, we're very unconscious, and we just fail. We just feel that we didn't make it because we didn't have enough talent and the rest of it. So then I think we've just got this ideological program just eating us alive, because it's so profoundly toxic. But we haven't crossed over to the other side to see that it is toxic, but that there's the higher rationale for it, which is that you have to become, a pathologically driven sociopath who is willing to transform into a beetle to to attain the ultimate goal.
And that's what I'm saying, we might actually, sadly, I mean, a lot of people might wake up one day and kind of come to the realization that malevolent Lovecraftian old ones aren't necessarily the worst overlords that we could have, and maybe the wanton killing and destruction that such a thing would unleash wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Again, I'm kind of reminded of In the Mouth of Madness, when society was breaking down in there and essentially the public at large just going, you know, insane. They were running around just randomly murdering one in each other, dismembering each other. It's as strange as it may sound, I actually think there are some people out there that would love to bring about that kind of insanity into the real world.
And again, I think there's a large number of consumers who dream of just such a future, the Walking Dead.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's, you know, another thing that kind of is unsettling about the rise of VR, because, I mean, you know that there are going to be people out there that are going to use this to live out their fantasies, to, you know, murder people, to rape them, to abuse children and so forth. And at some point, is that going to translate into the real world? Well, certainly that could be, you know, a potential end game that some of this technology is viewed as producing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you kind of see that as well also with the sex robots or whatever. I don't know exactly the technical terms they're using for this now, but I know that's already been kind of put forth. Well, this would be a great tool for, you know, pedophiles, because now instead of going out and abusing an actual child, well, they could just get a synthetic one and abuse, and that'll make everybody happy, so to speak.
Yeah, and Richard Dawkins advocating cannibalism once we have genetically modified meat, because then we can have the experience of eating human flesh without committing any crime, and therefore free ourselves of one more meaningless taboo.
Certainly, certainly. Dawkins, I believe that was another guy who had been affiliated with Epstein, too.
I hadn't heard that.
I might be off on that one, or at least maybe some of the individuals he was associated were traveling the same orbits as Epstein. I'm not 100% sure about that one, but he would hardly be surprising to find in the list of people that were affiliated with Epstein.
No, it wouldn't to me, anyway. So, I mean, before we end up as quivering blobs of jelly here by trying to gaze at the abyss of the future, or the present even, maybe let's bring it back to the small and the manageable, which is Peter Lavender. I mean, he's the sort of eel that we've microchipped here. Well, let's see, what more can we ask? I mean, one of the things that's most compelling about Lavender to me is how effectively he's infiltrated the what we might think of as counterculture, depending on the period. So in the 70s, as Simon, he infiltrated the counterculture via the interest in occultism, and he was, I think, inarguably, he was instrumental in helping to water that plant of the growing interest in occultism and turn it into a whole movement. So I'm not sure exactly the chronology, but I think the Necronomicon predated Lavey's Satanic Bible, is that right?
This
came after.
I'm not sure when exactly he published it, but certainly the Church of Satan was already active well before the Simon Necronomicon was released.
Okay, so yeah, because actually LaVey was in the late 60s, wasn't it? Temple of Satan and the Necronomicon was 77, I believe. So
yeah, I would imagine, yeah, the Satanic Bible most likely did predate the Necronomicon then.
Okay, well, so, and they're both on the bestseller list today, and if you've done a little Amazon surfing, you'll probably find, as I did, that both the Necronomicon and the Satanic Bible are in the top 10 occultist books.
Not surprising.
Yeah,
disturbing, but not surprising.
So very effective there. And then if we, in the present, it doesn't seem to be quite so effective. We've got the Tom DeLonge thing, and then in the middle we've got his seemingly more legitimate research that he put his name on, which was the stuff about the Nazis, which was initially endorsed by Norman Mailer. So he had that intellectual kind of New York elite clout, and then that led to Sinister Forces with Trine Day, which we could talk about. But obviously the Sinister Forces are sort of touchstones for within the conspiracy culture, within the counterculture of today. So that, I mean, that's very compelling to me because it's somebody who is appears to be one thing and is another, and it raises a lot of questions, one of which is, which you've touched on, which is how much do these groups that are creating and implementing ideologies, how much do they actually believe and practice them, and how much are they using them as a psyop to generate and inflame superstition as a way to manipulate people and to shape the culture. And I wonder if it's possible to look at Lavender at, as a microcosm there, at least to speculate, but with a bit more ground to refer to. What's your sense about Lavender? Is your sense that he's a true believer who's promoting these occult beliefs that he adheres to and has practiced to his own empowerment, and that he even wants to turn a religion, create a religion out of them? Or do you believe that he's more like what we might think of as an agent, undercover agent, who's simply assuming, a guise in order to deliver certain ideas as a means to manipulate the target audience?
In Lavenda's case, I tend to lean towards him being a true believer, simply because I don't think, in the grand scheme of things, he's very high up the ladder, so to speak.
Right.
Which is why, as a true believer, he probably would have been much more easily to be manipulated by those that were above him. But certainly, I mean, the possibility that those above him are using him as a psyop or something with his ideology isn't, something that can be discounted easily. And this is something that, I had been. Bit of a change of topic here, but something I had uncovered that I go into in my upcoming book here. And one of the things was essentially the links between MK Ultra and psychological warfare or political warfare, whatever you want to call it. And that was something that I hadn't really considered. I mean, certainly when we think of MK Ultra, we usually tend to associate it on the personal level with people that were individually tortured in this program for, whatever purposes and so forth. But one of the interesting discoveries I came up in the research was the relations between a guy named Frank Barnett and people that were involved with MK Ultra, specifically Colonel James Monroe, who was one of the main guys in the was it the Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology or something to that effect. It was one of the principal conduits of funding for MK Ultra in the 50s and 60s. Monroe was the guy who had to sign off on a lot of this kind of stuff. Now, Barnett, by contrast, had been involved with a far-right organization called the American Security Council in the 1950s. The ASC was, in a lot of ways, the far-right's answer to the Council on Foreign Relations, but it was also a vast private intelligence network as well, deeply involved in blacklisting and so forth. Now, Barnett hooked up with Monroe in the late 1950s, going to some of the military conferences that the ASC was sponsoring, and then he went on to become involved in an organization called the National Center for Information Strategy or something to that effect. It's the NCIS. If you look up on my blog, you can find the actual name of it. I'm a little vague right now, so many organizations to keep track of, but okay, so Barnett basically was involved initially with indoctrinating elites, and then through this later organization, the NCIS, trying to indoctrinate the public at large. And the thing about the American Security Council, and this is, what's kind of interesting to me in this context of what you're talking about, is the ASC for years was the principal engine behind a lot of the Alex Jones type conspiracy theories. I mean, almost everything related to the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Federal Reserve and all of this kind of stuff originated with the ASC, and then through more extreme groups that were closely linked to it, like the John Birch Society and so forth. And when you go back and look at a lot of this stuff, it kind of has the inevitable effect of depicting a lot of these institutions as being invincible, so to speak. I mean, the Council of Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg Group, they've already considered all the angles. They plotted everything out. You can't stop them. And it kind of gives this perception to people who are, reading this stuff, okay, I'm enlightened, I've woken up and so forth, I'm aware of what's going on, but I can't do anything about it. There's nothing that can be done. They've already considered everything. So, let's just, get high or something like that and just, not think about it. And, to some extent, you have to wonder, well, is Lavinia's ideology being promoted for a singular purpose? Is he going to try to depict these malevolent entities that there's just no way that we can even begin to stop them? And as a result of that, will the public at large simply become disillusioned, apathetic about all of this?
Well, there's another possibility that actually occurs to me that it may also be what I was hinting at before, a way to infiltrate us with the ideology so that it will disempower us, but not simply by giving up, but by, like Manson again, by attempting to wield the tools that we think that we're being given, such as knowledge, without the real context and without the actual necessary preparation that comes from really discovering stuff. Because if you just get given a whole bunch of knowledge, like in the trilogy Sinister Forces, either you get paralyzed, so what do you do with it, or you get galvanized, and you try and apply the knowledge, but you can't because you can't even verify half of it. But you haven't really come upon it in a methodical way through researching and referring back to your own life and experience in a way that actually would be more holistic, let's say. So that's been my sense of sort of an insight I've been having recently, and because my own research was always, well, not always, this is the point, I guess. In the early years, I just used to refer to these other books and then, grab this, that, and the other, and then kind of build upon them. I think this was how I was able to connect to someone like Kenneth Grant, because he recognized that I was more or less on message. I'd imbibed the ideological, components that had been distributed, and was recycling them. So I was more or less a friendly, voice. But those books I kind of look back on with disdain and a bit of embarrassment. My Aeolus Cephas ones, I was advocating a future where we transformed into beetles. I had drunk the Kool-Aid. My more recent books are much more rooted in my direct experience, and they're much more going to sort, not source documents, I don't do freedom of information, but really going to more mainstream articles and news reporting and so on and so forth, rather than going to other disseminators of paranoid awareness. So I think that I've really learned the hard way that there's a right way and there's a wrong way to go about this process.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think another kind of dark side to this, besides, I mean, obviously a lot of people that go into some of the conspiracy stuff are just going to become apathetic. But then, kind of at the really dark side of that other end of the spectrum is going into what I kind of think of as a soldier of the apocalypse mode. And I mean, you can kind of see this personified by, say, somebody like Fraser Glenn Miller, who had been involved with the National States Rights Party in the 70s and kind of linked into all of these, right-wing groups surrounding the American Security Council and so forth. This was a guy who was eventually made an FBI informant, and despite the fact that he had been involved in numerous acts of terrorism, including the Greensboro Massacre, where several civil rights workers were murdered in the 1970s, and finally climaxing with the Overland Park Jewish Community Center shooting a couple of years ago. Basically, to even get this guy arrested, he had to walk into effectively a synagogue and start shooting it up. So, this is kind of the other end of the spectrum where it's like, well, instead of, being apathetic, lash out against the system, but do it in a very violent and singular fashion that is not going to accomplish anything other than, demonizing the movement from which you're coming from, more or less.
Yeah, and even conspiracy theory becomes then tainted with that
Yes.
association.
It's kind of like the whole Pizzagate thing. Well, this is actually dangerous because it's getting people to go into, I mean, innocent businesses of innocent bystanders and threaten them with rifles and so forth, or even worse, I mean, start shooting up places. I mean, you could kind of point to, what was his name? Dylann Roof, I think, the guy, Root or something, who had shot up the Black Church a couple of years ago. he was also linked into a lot of the same type of ideology. And I mean, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, this is just disastrous for anybody who has any kind of interest in alternative interpretations of, you know, our political history over the last couple of years and what's going on now, because it tends to lump everyone in, you know, as kind of a crazy, a potential terrorist or something in the minds of the public at large.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Recluse from Vice Up. For more from Recluse, click on the link in the show notes or go to viceupview.blogspot.com. And for part two of this conversation, just go to Horticulture, the same page that you hopefully listened to this, where you might have been using your apps and whatnot. So you're just going to have to go to my website. And while you're there, why not donate something or buy one or two of my books? This is Jason Horsley for The Limitless, the podcast between. I am a rock star. Just like